Iran rules out any bilateral talks with the U.S. on the 2015 nuclear deal. It calls on Washington to live up to its commitments under the accord. Russia hits back at the U.S. and the EU for their condemnations of Moscow's response to the recent opposition protests. Indian police step up security and block main roads leading to the capital, New Delhi, to prevent protesting farmers from entering the city. Good day, everyone. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behram Sajjadeh. Good to have you with us. Now, starting with our top story, Tehran has again emphasized its stance on the 2015 nuclear deal. It stresses that the country is awaiting Washington's action.
Iran is waiting for the U.S. to act, which means the removal of sanctions effectively. We want to see all sanctions are lifted, which former U.S. President Donald Trump had imposed on Iran in violations of international laws and accords, including U.N. Security Council Resolution 2231 and the JCPOA.
The official said that it would not be sufficient to see developments on paper. Rather, Tehran wants to see sanctions lifted in real. The spokesman also ruled out any bilateral talks with the U.S. on the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, urging the new administration to correct the wrongdoings of its predecessor. Iran started scaling down its JCPOA-related commitments since the U.S. withdrawal from the deal and its reimposition of unilateral sanctions. Tehran has time and again said that the move is reversible if other parties abide by their commitments under the accord. Russia has condemned the stances adopted by the U.S. and the European Union as regards the recent anti-government rallies in that country. I've discussed that issue with our guests in our news review program. Russia has lashed out at the United States and European Union after they denounced Moscow's response to the recent rallies in that country. Dmitry Polyansky, Russia's first deputy permanent representative to the UN, accused the EU of pursuing double standard toward Moscow. That after EU foreign policy chief Josep Borrell said that Russia has resorted to widespread detentions and disproportionate use of force against protesters and journalists. The Russian Foreign Ministry also accused the United States of gross interference in the country's affairs, and that after Washington made a similar allegation. Several Russian cities have witnessed rallies in the past days over the detention of opposition figure Alexei Navalny. Hundreds have been arrested during demonstrations which the Kremlin calls unauthorized. Let's get some insight and opinion on this. So joining me will be John Stepling, author and commentator from Inderøy, Norway. And also we'll have Brian Berletic, independent geopolitical analyst, joining us out of Bangkok. Russians are calling these protests unauthorized. Police also gave them some warning, as it was reported. And now Russia is blaming the EU for almost the same thing, and maybe even worse, the way that police is handling even the coronavirus restrictions, you know, rallies that we just had the pictures.
Well, I don't know the extent of the Russian state response to the protests. I've read differing reports. Remember, Navalny is written about in gushing terms by the New York Times. He's the darling of Western mainstream press, in a sense, although his politics are much closer to, I don't know, Donald Trump than they are to anybody else's if he were an American. But of course there's a double standard. Of course there's just jaw-dropping hypocrisy when you look at the coverage of the Western press to the French police and the crackdown against the Yellow Vests, German state response to protests, Austrian. Across the EU, there have been massive protests this last year, some against the lockdown, some against just unemployment, economic stagnation. And the media in the West has been absolutely silent about all of the crackdowns against these protesters. I mean, they were particularly vicious in France, actually, and yet with complete silence when people protested the lockdowns, complete silence in the West. The whole Navalny story, though, is so riddled with holes and the usual anti-Russian propaganda And factoring into this, of course, is the Nord Stream pipeline, Nord Stream 2 pipeline, you know, and Putin is being blamed for things that he has no rational reason to have done or to have been behind. Mm-hmm. It all feels like the typical U.S. interference in the affairs of other states, frankly. I don't even know how seriously to take the protests in Russia, frankly, because I don't know how seriously to take any Navalny story, any story connected with him. So, you know, the Russian response is probably really justified. We're looking at the usual media bias from the West.
Right. Over to Bangkok. Brian, when something similar happens, or even worse, like the way that police in the U.S. is treating black protesters, then we don't have the EU criticizing them usually, or what's happening in European countries. And we have seen that, and they are going on as we speak. And they are not usually criticized by the media or any international organization. Why is that?
That's because everything that the Western media talks about, it's all driven by a political agenda. So when we have the protests in Russia, the Western media is going to portray Russia as being heavy-handed against them. As was just discussed, Alexei Navalny is a U.S.-backed opposition figure. He was a co-founder of an organization called Democratic Alternative, which was revealed by U.S. cables, leaked by WikiLeaks, to be funded by the National Endowment for Democracy. So just as has been said, there's this double standard, and it's all driven by political motivations. This idea of human rights and free speech and freedom of assembly, these are all principles that the U.S. and Western Europe hide behind. They hide that agenda behind these principles. They don't actually uphold them. So that's why we see, just as the other guest said, this jaw-dropping hypocrisy.
Okay, appreciate your comments and insight. We had John Stepling, author and commentator from Indroy, and Brian Berletic, independent geopolitical analyst out of Bangkok. Welcome back. Moving on with the rest of this broadcast. Indian police have beefed up security and blocked main roads leading to capital New Delhi to try to prevent protesting farmers from entering the city. Police and paramilitary forces have dug up trenches and put razor wires on highways as the finance minister is set to deliver her annual budget plan in Parliament. Security is ramped up around Parliament and other public buildings. There are also internet and communication blackouts in several neighborhoods. Well, that days after a tractor rally by farmers on India's Republic Day turned violent, with some protesters storming into the capital's iconic Red Fort. Farmers set protests for months, demanding the government repeal a set of agricultural laws. The government rejects the call, arguing that reform is aimed at boosting rural economies. Myanmar's ruling National League for Democracy Party says its leader Aung San Suu Kyi has urged the public to protest against a military coup d'etat. The party said that Suu Kyi suspects that the military would once again put the country under dictatorship. The military has declared a one-year state of emergency and said that power has now been handed over to the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. Suu Kyi and other senior figures were detained in the early morning raid. There are also communication blackouts, and soldiers are patrolling outside the city hall in the largest city, Yangon. The coup d'etat and detentions come after days of escalating tensions between the government and the military. The generals claim that the last parliamentary elections were fraudulent. In the meantime, international reactions are pouring in over the detention of Myanmar's de facto leader and other political figures during a military coup. The UN has strongly condemned the detentions and urged the military to respect the will of the people. Washington called for an immediate release of detained officials, warning the Myanmarese military of a response from the U.S. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson and EU officials denounced a coup in the Southeast Asia country. Australia, Japan, Indonesia, and China have also reacted, calling for a lawful and peaceful resolution to the crisis. Myanmar's Rohingya Muslims, who have taken refuge in neighboring Bangladesh, have also slammed the coup and called for international assistance. talked to international lawyer Barry Grossman a short while ago about the root cause of the tensions in Myanmar.
Military junta, which has always been sitting there in the background, might have something to say about the direction the country's been moving in or not moving, as the case may be. And of course, the junta, along with opposition parties, have taken the position that the recent election in 2020, in November, was also replete with election fraud. And it's worth noting that in that election that the NLD, that is Aung San Suu Kyi's party, won 396 out of 476 seats. So that was really very much a massive win for them. But even the Election Commission has admitted that there were some substantial problems with election lists. And of course, the opposition have claimed, along with the military, that there were millions, literally 8 million individual cases of election fraud that they identified, something disputed by the Election Commission. But it's also important to recall that as far as elections go and democracy goes, many electorates were banned from participating in the election. The entire state of Rakhine was, to one extent or another, excluded. Certainly, Rohingya Muslims that remain in Myanmar were excluded from voting, as well as some other ethnic minorities. So it's hard to really see that even the 2020 election is some kind of pillar of democracy.
Myanmar's Rohingya Muslim population has been going through tough times in the past years. In August 2017, hundreds of thousands of them fled an army crackdown in their homeland and took refuge in neighboring Bangladesh. And since then, the Rohingya have lived in overcrowded camps in Bangladesh. Now the authorities there have started relocating them to a remote, uninhabited island, despite calls to stop that move.
Bangladesh's government sent another group of Rohingya Muslim refugees to a remote and deserted island in the Bay of Bengal. More than 1,400 refugees set sail for the island of Basanchar. It was the fourth group sent to the island, and the Bangladeshi government plans to eventually move 100,000 Rohingya to the remote island. Bangladesh also aims to decongest refugee camps in Cox's Bazar, which shelters approximately 1 million Rohingya. The relocations began in December and have been criticized by human rights groups, who say that many of the refugees are being forced to move against their will. The government of Bangladesh says the relocation is voluntary, but many refugees have talked about the move as being coerced. Rights organizations say the Bangladeshi government used cash incentives as well as intimidation tactics to force Rohingya to accept the relocation offer. Bangladeshi authorities say the relocation is essential to ensure better living conditions for the refugees and to improve the camps in Cox's Bazar.
As a matter of fact, Bangladesh and India were among the countries which from the beginning opposed the incoming of these refugees. As a matter of fact, they identified them as terrorists and they did not give them what their rights under international law and under the humanitarian law as refugees. And we see that it's continuing. They see the Rohingya Muslims as a problem rather than sort of oppressed people that they need to be supported at this hour of need.
The refugee camp became overcrowded from August 2017, when Rohingya Muslims began fleeing their homes in Rakhine State following waves of attacks by Myanmar's army and Buddhist mobs. Hundreds of thousands of Muslims were violently uprooted in the months that followed, driven by a brutal military crackdown that killed thousands of them. What happened in August 2017 was so horrific that the UN called it genocide and a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. Those who survived the brutal killings sought refuge in Bangladesh and neighboring countries, hoping for a day to return home. But for now, it seems that thousands of them have to go on yet another perilous journey.
What is the new place that Rohingya Muslim refugees are being relocated to? The new destination came into existence only 2 decades ago. It's a poorly prone to natural disasters like cyclones and flooding. No one ever lived on that island before the construction of settlements for the Rohingya began there. Now, the plight of the Rohingya Muslims has been running for a long time. They're considered to be the world's most persecuted minority group, and their relocation by Bangladesh to a remote island is just the latest in the difficulties that they have been facing. Now, this is the question. Are the Rohingyas being moved to a place that will eventually lead to their death?
The Rohingya are the world's most persecuted ethnic minority, haunted by the past and denied a future. A citizenship law in 1982 stripped them of the nationality, making them one of the world's largest stateless communities. While there have been waves of exodus to Bangladesh since the 1970s, none was as rapid and massive as the one in August 2017 that turned the spotlight on the Rohingya crisis around the world. Today, Bangladesh alone is home to nearly a million Rohingya refugees. At least half of those who arrived in the country were children. The UN says the migration was unprecedented in terms of volume and speed. These people know that they cannot stay in Cox's Bazar forever, but it seems that they are not wanted anywhere in this world.
Well, they're not really stateless in reality. They have a right to be its citizens of Myanmar. They've been denied that basic fundamental right. It's not the fact that, by history, they are stateless. Their citizenship has been denied. And you're absolutely right. That is the heart of the problem. And it will not be resolved unless the international community force the Myanmar government to rise up and accept their responsibility for looking after their own citizens.
There were talks of the Rohingya repatriation for the past couple of years, but to this day, nothing has happened. The main reason is that Myanmar's government was always unwilling to accept the refugees. Bangladesh has time and again pushed hard to begin the repatriation, but Myanmar has been delaying it, saying that it needs more time for logistical arrangements. The Rohingya Muslims also fear for their safety in case they return to their country. A UN fact-finding mission in Myanmar says that approximately 600,000 Rohingya are still inside the country, living under the threat of genocide. The world body says no refugees will agree to be repatriated without assurance of full citizenship, ethnic rights, to settle back in Myanmar. Given the Myanmar's leaders' reluctance to address the issue, the minority group's fate is a major cause for concern that is only being voiced by a select group of countries around the world.
Moving on, one more incident of police brutality in the United States. Body cam footage released by police in the state of Rochester shows officers spraying a 9-year-old black girl with pepper while handcuffed. The girl was seen being forced to get inside a patrol car while she was crying and calling for her father. The Rochester Police Department claimed that the officers responded to a report of family trouble and used force when the girl refused to follow commands. However, the mayor condemned the force against the kid and pledged an internal review of city's law enforcement practices. Also, the city's police chief called the incident unacceptable. The footage sparked fresh outrage over police brutality against African Americans. U.S. police are infamous for racial profiling against minorities, especially people of color. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
First revolution that started with the people, continued with the people, did not change its word, did not change its way, did not decrease or increase its goals, is the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Ayatollah Khamenei.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on February 18, 2019 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, during a meeting with the people of East Azerbaijan. The meeting was held at Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya in commemoration of the anniversary of Tabriz uprising of February 18, 1978.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, all praise is due to Allah, the Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master and Prophet, Abul Qasim al-Mustafa Muhammad, and upon his pure, immaculate, chosen, infallible, and purifying household, especially the one remaining with Allah on earth. You're very welcome, dear brothers, dear sisters, and ulama, outstanding personalities, honorable families of martyrs, and enthusiastic and peerless youth of Tabriz. Indeed, the people of Tabriz, in particular, the youth of that city, are unique and peerless in the country. I am very happy to have thankfully had the opportunity to meet you at this Husseiniya on one of the days of Allah, the 29th of Bahman, which is truly one of the days of Allah. First of all, I would like to say that this day of Allah was created by the people of Tabriz. Days of Allah are days during which Allah the Exalted manifests Himself in a special manner. Sometimes, people's intentions, determination, and willpower create such days. The people of Tabriz created this day on the 29th of Bahman of 1356 with their determination and insight. I will expand on this matter later on. Of course, that was not the first time, and it was not the last time either.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
Our recent history is imbued with the important participation of the people of Tabriz and Azerbaijan on important matters and in significant and determining events. If you look at the post-revolutionary era, the first events after the revolution, of course, you do not remember those days. The people of Tabriz worked a miracle in the true sense of the word. The plot which had been orchestrated by the enemy in Tabriz was foiled by the people of Tabriz themselves, and they did so in the best way possible. Everyone was worried about what would happen in Tabriz. The anti-revolutionary enemies had assembled their troops with the aim of separating Tabriz from the revolution. However, Imam said that the people should not be worried, because the people of Tabriz will respond to them on their own. And this was exactly what would happen. Later on, during the Sacred Defense era and the subsequent events, after that, in the year 1388 and following that, on the 9th of Dey, the whole country staged a demonstration on the 9th of Dey, but the people of Tabriz did so on the 8th of Dey, one day sooner than everyone else. The people of Azerbaijan thankfully played a leading role.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
The brawl between amateur investors and Wall Street professionals began with hedge funds and big corporations shorting the stock or betting on several small companies' fall of share prices. That captivated people's attention on social media, and in the wake of it, online campaigns led to the buying of the company's stock with aim of pushing up the price. Companies like GameStop were shorted by hedge funds and were labelled as failing by big investors. However, the online movement dramatically soared prices with its stock, trading between $112 and $480 a share. That's up from around $18 a share a few weeks ago. That's while some investors were also hoping to make a quick buck, and others seeking to squeeze the hedge funds. The movement cost hedge funds and other big investors dearly, causing investment platforms such as Robinhood to put a ban on trading stock for GameStop, AMC, BlackBerry Limited, the Nokia Corporation, and several other companies, which resulted in shares to fall by 50%. This ignited protests outside the company's California headquarters and in the Manhattan banking district yesterday. Also, groups of angry protesters gathered in front of New York's Stock Exchange and chanted, "I want my money, and I want it now." They were also holding up signs which read, "Tax Wall Street and tax the rich." The act of restricting stock trade sparked lawsuits and called for investigations from lawmakers. Consequently, the Robinhood's co-founder, Vlad Tenev, announced that the suspension of trading of the stocks will be lifted, though only a limited amount of shares could be traded under the company's supervision. He also rejected the notion that this act is in favour of the hedge funds. The war between amateur investors and Wall Street has caused mayhem in the US stock market, with professional investors calling stock movements being obviously disconnected from fundamentals. However, how powerful are the big corporations, and can they restrict investors from buying shares and stopping individuals gaining a slice of the cake?
I think what we're seeing is people are extremely frustrated because a subgroup of people on Reddit have been able to game the system of Wall Street in their favor against billion-dollar hedge fund managers, and they're finally seeing a clamoring for regulation all of a sudden on Wall Street now that it's the people at the top that are being affected. For decades, for centuries, the Wall Street fat cats have been able to profit off the misery of others. They've made billions, trillions of dollars. They've gotten bailouts. They've done speculative measures. They've profited off of the misery of others, and yet nothing has happened.
Regulators in the United States have warned that the situation is under their scrutiny following a number of share trading platform suspension of trade stocks of the GameStop company and several other firms. One of these share trading platforms is Robinhood, A company that's been accused of gamifying share trades, Robinhood, is also under fire for its decision to suspend trading and has sparked outrage among investors who accuse the firm of working in favor of hedge funds and big Wall Street investors who are losing millions of dollars to an army of novice traders. The anger has now spread beyond the investment community, with US politicians joining the backlash against Wall Street. Democratic Representative Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez has called the restriction unacceptable, calling for more details to be published on Robinhood's decision. She also criticized suspending retail investors from purchasing stocks, while hedge funds are free to trade as they wished.
People are upset. People are upset that they have been able to outsmart those on Wall Street and turn a bigger profit for themselves. Some people were able to turn $30,000 into $1 million, etc. They want to continue to be able to do that, and they see this as an attack on the free market. Obviously, the market has never been free, and it continues to be a game that's completely rigged. But I think the defining point is the fact that finally the free market was able somehow to be used to help those who are more at the bottom than more at the top, and obviously you have the free market intervening to prevent this from happening further.
It seems that the online mania to steal from the rich and give to the poor has been betrayed by Robin Hood, who seems to be the real sheriff of Nottingham in this case. However, the fury against control of the system of big corporations and hedge funds has left people with no choice but to unite. But could the army of novice investors win a battle against the Goliath of big corporations and hunt down the real wolves of Wall Street?
The coronavirus pandemic has become an endless nightmare for much of the world. Despite the development and distribution of a range of new vaccines, many countries are still struggling to battle the deadly waves of the highly transmissible disease. As the world steps up efforts to contain the deadly virus, new variants are rapidly replacing older versions, making the situation even more frightening. Many thousands of people lose their lives every day worldwide, despite restrictive measures that have paralyzed economies. The pandemic could get much worse before it gets better. The world is undoubtedly eager to find out how the whole thing began so that future risks can be minimized. The origin of COVID-19 has been a major bone of contention, especially between the world's worst coronavirus-hit country, the United States, and China, where the deadly virus was first detected in December 2019. The two sides have exchanged barbs over the origin of the crisis. Now all eyes are focused on a fact-finding mission on the origins of the pandemic. A team of scientists from the World Health Organization is right now in the Chinese city of Wuhan trying to find out the origins of the outbreak. The WHO says its fact-finding mission in Wuhan is purely scientific, but the probe is facing a political minefield. The World Health Organization team will carry out on-the-ground investigations into the source of the new coronavirus. The WHO scientists will visit different places in Wuhan and talk to people and officials. The WHO says all hypotheses are on the table during the probe. The WHO team is expected to inspect a seafood market in Wuhan, which was linked to many of the first COVID-19 cases in December 2019. The scientists will also visit hospitals that treat coronavirus patients in the city. But how much will the team of investigators be able to uncover? The WHO experts face a tough task as the city has been repeatedly disinfected. The investigation is ongoing in Wuhan, but there have been cautions against expecting any breakthroughs soon. It could take years before any firm conclusions can be reached. What's making the WHO mission even tougher is the fact that it has been highly politicized. Several countries, particularly the United States, accuse the Chinese government of hiding the outbreak's severity during its early stages. The administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump kept criticizing China for alleged failures in containing the outbreak and refusing to tell the truth. The WHO itself was branded by Trump as a, quote, puppet of China.
The Chinese government has dismissed Western allegations, saying the virus might have begun outside of China. Trump is now gone, but the White House is keeping up pressure on Beijing. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki expressed concern this week about what she called misinformation coming out of China. Beijing has warned against any negative speculation and politicized interpretation of the fact-finding mission. Will the WHO scientists be able to carry out their investigation properly despite all the political pressure?
Obviously, the scientific medical investigation may help for future prevention or development of science in terms of understanding how viruses change and how the pandemic started and how the new virus originated. Obviously, among scientists, or at least the majority of scientists, believe what happened is a natural mutation of the virus.
Observers believe that the scientists should be allowed to complete their work independently because the results could prove vital for the future of mankind.
What was planned by the Dutch government as a system to prevent the rapid spread of the COVID-19 virus in the Netherlands has turned sour, as it seems that the curfew imposed has been met with staunch opposition, with four nights of rioting taking place across the country, causing shops to be looted, infrastructure to be damaged, and police having to react to contain the disturbance. With police facing rioters on the front line, water cannons, CS gas, and other forms of police force have had to be deployed, resulting in hundreds of arrests being made and fines allocated to those who break the curfew rules. Yet it seems after four nights of violence involving a crowd formed by a majority of youths, the police have managed to take hold of the situation as protests have died down as the consequences of the actions of the rioters are being met with a tough stance by the police and the government. In fact, the reaction by the Dutch government is one of anger, as it claims that all damage will be paid for by those responsible. A tough task to apply, but something that the government of Mark Rutte is keen to go through with, as echoed by the Dutch finance minister, who has labelled the rioters as scum. Many of the protests and rioters are complaining about the measures being taken by the Dutch government when it comes to containing and dealing with the virus, claiming a curfew still does not eradicate the virus. But many in the Netherlands do not agree with the protests, stating that only a small minority of people are causing so much trouble.
Well, we're very sorry about it. It's just really unfortunate, actually. I have a feeling that most of these people, not all of them, some are genuine protesters against corona rules, right? But most of them are just people who usually attend football matches and just are looking for rioting, etc. And that's really unfortunate. I mean, that's just not what all of the Netherlands is. I mean, this is just like 0.1% of population, or maybe 0.01% of population. It's very unfortunate that it gets such a lot of international attention.
With a country very much like the rest of Europe, impatient to get the vaccines rolled out, hence allowing life to return to some kind of normality, it remains to be seen what will happen until then. However, deep in the mix of the protests, yet still visible enough to be seen, it seems that the protests and riots are a stage for another form of demonstration in the Netherlands, one that may yet again rise its ugly head in the near future. Many countries across the world have seen the effects of the pandemic affect their social well-being, causing many people to reach boiling point, as over 12 months of hardship has seen the world change the way it performs, even the most benign of duties. Yet worryingly, in the Netherlands, pockets of protests have included political groups, which most concerning of all, contain far-right movements, with evidence suggesting that the Dutch branch of the German-born Pegida ideology has been counted amongst the protesters. The Netherlands has a strong far-right influence in its political parties, and this has been reflected by some far-right politicians calling on the Dutch military to step in and protect the streets of the country against the rioters, something that suggests the current plan to control the situation by the police may just not be enough, in spite of a calmer last day or two. But the Netherlands, as we know, has a strong anti-immigrant and in particular anti-Muslim following, inspired by the likes of far-right leader Geert Wilders, who in his past rhetoric has made his feelings very clear about certain communities living in the country.
Look at the Islamization of our country. If a Dutch person driving in a car drives 5 miles too fast, he will be fined within a minute, whereas the Moroccan scum in Holland, and once again, not all are scum, but there is a lot of Moroccan scum in Holland who makes the streets unsafe, mostly young people, and they are not taken seriously. We are making them and the people unsafe, and this should change.
With far-right groups such as Pediger now emerging in the shadows of the protests, could this openly public sentiment fall into the hands of far-right leaders such as Geert Wilders, who may use the surge in feelings to fuel his campaign to bring the far-right up another notch on the political spectrum, especially as the Dutch are due to face an upcoming election following the resignation of current Prime Minister Mark Rutte following a welfare payment scandal. There's no doubt that far-right groups across Europe are still very much in place, and although the COVID-19 virus has played its part on diverting attention away from politics for now, could the example seen in the Dutch protests and riots be the catalyst for other far-right groups in Europe to jump on the bandwagon and politicise the virus to their own benefits?
January 26 is remembered by many Australians as a national day, with many celebrating the occasion with pomp and show to mark the anniversary of the 1788 arrival of a group of British ships called the First Fleet at Port Jackson in New South Wales and the raising of the British flag at Sydney Cove by Arthur Phillip. The part of the celebrations was hoisting an Australian flag over Sydney's Opera House and displaying the word Austay on the sky over the Sydney Harbour. But the celebrations of the origins of a modern nation are a time of mourning for Indigenous Australians who have endured discriminations despite inhabiting the land for centuries. They view the arrival of British settlers 200 years ago as the beginning of pain and suffering. They even brand the Australia Day as Invasions Day. That's why thousands of people, mainly Indigenous, defied coronavirus restrictions on Tuesday and took to the streets in several cities to highlight their plight. Some protesters chanted a slogan such as "Sovereignty was never ceded" and "No justice, no peace," while others held up placards reading "Not a day to celebrate" and "Black lives matter."
It's very important because the issues that we're facing here in Australia are not going to go away overnight. So until we start getting justice and start seeing change in this country, we will not stop. This will be continuous. We no longer call it Australia Day, it is now Invasion Day. Always was and always will be Invasion Day.
But why do Indigenous Australians view this auspicious day as Invasions Day?
There's a much wider recognition these days of the 26th of January as an invasion day or a survival day, because at least for the last generation or so, younger people have learned that the colonisation of this country was not simply a matter of settlement. It was a matter of brutal dispossession. It was a matter of genocide. It was a matter of trying to obliterate the culture of Indigenous people here. And at least for the last 30 or so years, there's been a recognition every year and some greater recognition in schools and universities of that sort of history. So there is now, as a result, this very strong tension between the ongoing celebration of colonisation called Australia Day and the recognition of survival or Invasion Day, which is an important educative influence over younger people in this country.
Australia Day, which was formally declared a national holiday only in 1994, has increasingly heightened heated debates in recent years. The occasion is staunchly defended by right-wing commentators and retains strong support from the country's conservative government. Prime Minister Scott Morrison believes history changed forever in 1788 and that there was no escaping or cancelling that fact. He says for the better and worse, it was the moment where the journey to modern Australia began. But federal opposition leader Anthony Albanese has a totally different reading of the whole historical journey. This is Australia Day, is the one Australians need to acknowledge that it has been a very difficult day for the First Nations people.
In the first instance, it's important for us to recognise our own history and the consequences of our own history. and the fallout of that colonisation and dispossession, and the way in which the non-Aboriginal communities benefited from that and still benefit from that, and the ongoing enormous social advantage against Indigenous people in this country, which far outweighs that of any other community. So if we don't understand our own history, we can't have a resolution of contemporary problems. Secondly, because Australia is involved in a lot of adventures, a lot of neocolonial adventures in other countries, we can't recognise the problems of that and the problems of our own intervention in other countries unless we understand our own history and the colonisation of our own history.
Australia's Aboriginals currently represent around 3% of the country's population, but the most disadvantaged lot of the society. They are also said to be largely excluded in their limited capacity to participate in the decision-making or even control their own and mainstream social and cultural environment. From forcible separation of children from their families to their being displaced from their land, limited education and inadequate employment, discrimination has been widely recorded by advocacy groups. But how has the Australian Indigenous population been marginalised even to the present day?
Well, there's been enormous disadvantage. It occurs across the board. For example, Aboriginal people in prison are something like 14 to 15 times overrepresented. In education, there's been enormous disadvantage. In health, there's terrible disadvantage. As I said, there's no other group, no other ethnic group or community that is nearly as disadvantaged as Aboriginal people, despite the fact that large amounts of money have been spent on particular programs, but they haven't achieved success because there's a very deep cultural alienation, for example, from the institutions and the educational institutions of Australia.
All in all, what needs to be done is for the Australian government to put an end to the misery of the Indigenous people and take steps to make it not look like they're from another planet.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illa Allah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar.
This is part of a speech of Imam Khomeini, the founder of Islamic Revolution, on ethics and politics. You will face rebellious acts of your selfish desires unless you are purified and purged. Knowledge and science will inflict harm if you are not purified. In that case, the most dangerous matter for you will be accepting a social position which will annihilate you in both worlds. You should purify yourself and bring your selfish desires under full control before taking positions. June 2nd, 1981.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Many congratulations on the victory anniversary of the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is the Islamic Revolution of Iran, basically. And it is an Islamic revolution. Why is it Islamic revolution? It's because of the man who was behind it, and he is known as Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi, the great scholar, a mystic, a scholar of jurisprudence. And we can see that obviously after the Islamic Revolution, how Islam spread in the world, not only within the Iranian community, but obviously in the neighbor countries, and not just the neighbor countries, but the Western world as well. So that we can see in today's world that because of this spread of Islam, because of this revolution, this movement, today the enemies of Islam are talking about Islamic phobia. And all these things are why? Because they know that the Islam is a pure religion. As Imam Khomeini, in one of his sayings, he said that the Islam is the most superior school, and Islam is the more pure than all other schools in the world. So obviously this fear that we can see in the world, it is due to these reasons. Now, today we're going to talk about some of the topics that we have selected in relation to Imam Khomeini and his viewpoints. And today we want to talk about his viewpoint in relation between the religion and politics. What is religion and politics in the viewpoint of Imam Khomeini? Now, all of us know that Imam Khomeini was the man of Islam. And he was a man who was truly following Islam, truly following the religion. And according to him, the very first thing that we can say is that religion and politics were not two different things. He never thought that the religion is other than politics, or politics is something else other than religion. Yes, within the religions, we have politics, we have management, we have, for example, education, we have technology. All these things are the parts of religion, as we can see also in the life of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, that the Prophet was managing the Islamic Ummah from the mosque. So Imam Khomeini also had the same thoughts in relation between the religion and politics. From his viewpoint, what we can say is obviously the difference between the Imam Khomeini and the other scholars of his time, or maybe before them, was that Imam Khomeini had a belief that at the time of occultation, when the Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is in occultation, the Muslim Ummah should have their own state, and they should have a state in which they should perform, they should practice Islam. So basically, Imam Khomeini, in his view, we can see that he believed that the Muslims should have their own state. And the main difference between the Imam and the other scholars were that he believed that at the time of occultation of Imam of the time, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, the Muslims should have their own state so that they can freely practice Islam. Obviously, in his neighbor countries, you could see that, for example, in the subcontinent, he was seeing that the Hindus and Muslims were living together. And then we can see Pakistan being formed in 1947. And that was based on the Islam, obviously. And in the other countries were the same thing happening. So basically, even after in his neighbor country, he could see that they are not freely practicing the true Islam. Or even if they are free, they're not following the true Islam, true Muhammadan Islam. The main idea of Imam Khomeini was that to give people a state in which they should practice a true Muhammadan Islam. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Economic divide. Hello, welcome to Economic Divide with me, Kavit Ahway. We're on this week's show, we will be looking at the situation in Britain that sees the children there going hungry as poverty strikes. Now, Britain prides itself as a modern, developed, and multicultural nation, claiming to have an excellent social service that's designed to maintain the needs and demands of its 66.5 million people. However, recent reports have painted a very different picture of the so-called land of hope and glory, as poverty kicks in harder than ever following the effect of the COVID-19 pandemic and more so, Brexit. Now, with around 25% of the population living in poverty and 4.5 million of them living in deep poverty, the most severely affected are the children, with Child Poverty Action Group showing that after housing costs have been calculated, just under 40% of British children live in poverty, according to IFS projections. Purple line here shows the after housing costs. Now, taking the view on a broader scale, the End Hunger UK charity have published some truly alarming figures, suggesting that, for example, one in four parents have skipped a meal as they cannot afford to eat. Also, one in four parents worry about not having enough food to eat and feed their families. And one in eight people in Britain go a whole day without eating any food at all. Now, that's around 8.3 million people based on the entire UK population. Well, let's now take a look at our first report, which covers a recent story emerging from Britain covering free school meals provided to underprivileged children in Britain, studying the less than impressive food packages that parents are expected to feed their children with.
Please, sir, I want some more.
What?
Please, sir, I want some more.
What's embarrassingly reminiscent of orphanages in Victorian times? British children are facing hunger on a scale not seen since Charles Dickens wrote about Oliver Twist in his famous novel. Yet here we are in 2021, and with Britain undergoing the toughest of times in its economic history as a direct result of the COVID-19 virus, and more worryingly, Brexit, the biggest victims of all the Tory government's failure are the children, with figures showing millions of them are now living in poverty in the towns and cities of Britain. With the country in its third lockdown, and figures showing that nearly 2,000 people are dying every day, the UK has had to react by closing down schools and learning facilities across the land. However, the problem does not lie in the children missing out on their education, as painful as that may seem. The biggest point is that for millions of British children, it means that they're missing out on their one square meal per day. As for those in poverty, food at home is nothing but a wishful dream. But it's not just the poorest families whose parents or guardians are out of employment that are suffering. As the economic situation in Britain becomes worse, parents who are in work are now finding things tougher than ever, as the purse strings grow ever tighter, meaning sacrifices have to be made.
We've had some people who were very in good jobs lose their jobs. And when they come to us, you can sense the stress and the anxiety, because they've always been able to provide for their families. They've never had to get the begging bowl out, so to speak.
For single parents or parents who are unable to work, the situation's even graver, with the United Nations rapporteur on poverty, Philip Alston, raising his concerns about how the people in Britain are slipping ever deeper into poverty.
I think the employment statistics are very impressive. I think poor people need to work when they can. But what we see is a huge amount of in-work poverty, and we see those who can't get work for whatever reason, because they're just not up to it, living in increasingly dire conditions.
So when Britain asked the government to vote on extending free school meals to underprivileged children during holidays and lockdown, the Tory government of Boris Johnson voted overwhelmingly to not provide the service, causing people to step in and take action, something that we'll touch on later on in the show. But what followed was a sham. Parents who started to finally receive emergency food packages took to social media to complain about the quality and quantity of food being sent to them, with many of them expected to feed their two children on half a tomato, half a pepper, a third of a carrot, and one potato for a whole week, something that children in the most impoverished nations in the world could have done better on, leaving the British government with egg on its face.
Joining me in the studio is current affairs and impact analyst Mahan Abedin and our special guest David Gordon, a professor of social justice and the director of the Bristol Poverty Institute at the University of Bristol. Mahan, welcome.
Let me
first
thank you.
You're welcome. Let me first start with Professor Gordon. Many thanks, Professor Gordon, for joining us. First up, recent images on social media that I'm sure you've seen in the news, and that's the school emergency lunches.